At Hennepin County, at least for the first several years, Commissioner Fernando was not consistently in a governing majority. And so the only way for us to work to get policy passed was to build relationships with people within departments and agencies across the county and find ways to get folks who, like, pretty explicitly are not supposed to necessarily work with you to work with you to develop policy in ways that achieve your stated aims and also, perhaps more importantly, don't create unintended outcomes so that by the time you bring a policy forward, it is well-researched, well-supported. It's got its footnotes and citations and everything that are required for good policy, and hopefully you line up the votes to pass. That's the type of approach I can bring to the state legislature.
We're rolling. We are rolling.
Rolling on. Tap. This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this. Stop this.
I've got plenty of time. I have nothing else going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.
Hennepin County has experienced a slight overall decline, but the city of Minneapolis has got, you know, a huge gap when it comes to commercial real estate valuation.
It makes me glad that the people who sued to stop the 2040 plan, it makes me glad that they won, because we were simply growing too fast here in Minneapolis. Put a stop to it.
That must be it. Jeez, that's a whole mess. But as you can imagine, campaigning at right now, you know, with in the delegate pool, there's less support for 2040 plan among delegates than there is among the general public. So,
oh really? You're finding there's a split there.
I saw them even in 62. Yeah, 62B. You'll find some people who are enemies of it.
Well, we're here on the Wedge Live podcast with Bill Emery, who is a candidate for 62B. I'm your host, John Edwards. We did the 61A candidates. Now we're on to 62B. All the open seats in the greater Wedge metro area. Bill Emery, policy aide for Hennepin County Commissioner Irene Fernando and a candidate for Minnesota House in 62B. Welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be on here.
I've been asking people as my first question, are you going to uphold the legacy of Frank Hornstein? But you have no Frank Hornstein legacy to uphold, but I still want to ask you about transit. I enjoy your website. Good job on the website.
Thank you.
Take a look at that. You have your issue page already fleshed out to a great degree, and you got some detail up there, so I like seeing that. Tell me what you're going to do to uphold Frank Hornstein's legacy.
Well, I think that Rep. Hornstein has been a pretty tireless advocate for improvements in our public transit system for decades now, along with climate action and a whole host of other issues. I am very excited to work on taking that $500 million a year that Metro Transit is getting now after we pass the metro area transit sales tax, and getting to work allocating some of those dollars towards improving service and infrastructure in the urban core. Metro Transit has programmed suburban commuters for quite some time and prioritized their needs. And I think that that's excellent, too. We need to be moving folks away from car travel in those ways as well, but especially with the changing nature of work, I think we need to be prioritizing our transit investments in communities where people are already using transit and where improved service and infrastructure could help us move from, you know, two car families ideally to one, and for those one car families that want to make the transition to car free lifestyles, that would be supported. So I want to see bus rapid transit service implemented on Cedar. I want to see it implemented on Lindale and Nicolet and probably 38th Street across the district, and make sure that what is programmed for Franklin Avenue happens on the timeline or faster that has been currently articulated. So in those ways, I would want to continue Frank's legacy, though as a freshman legislator, I certainly wouldn't have any gavels to wield. So it would take some time to get to that level of legacy, for sure.
It's kind of a shame we're losing a committee chair like that.
Yeah. I mean, it is the way of things. I mean, people serve until they're ready to not serve. And Frank has done more than his share of 3 a.m. legislative boondoggles at the end of May trying to get things done. And after 22 years, 11 sessions of that, I don't blame them at all for being willing to let someone else step in there and take a crack at it. So it is a loss. And also, you know, congrats to Frank on his decision to retire. That's a big decision.
Let's talk about your district now. Not enough of Frank Hornstein. Environmental justice. So from your website, you say one of your priorities is shut down the Smith Foundry, clean up the site, and repurpose for our community. And so it made me wonder, like, what is the mechanism at the state legislature to actually accomplish that?
Allocation of funds. So we need to buy them out. It's clear that the MPCA, whether by choice or by statute, is not going to pursue the course required to regulate their emissions such that our community is safe. That is not a, you know, this heavy industry function does not make sense in a densely populated urban neighborhood. And we need to buy them out. And then at that time we can start moving towards, you know, ascertaining the full extent of contamination and hopefully getting that cleaned up. And then finding a solution that aligns with community vision and needs. So I think that, you know, Elliott Park Neighborhood Incorporated doing the work on the Roof Depot site has really struck a good balance with that. And that process will probably need to begin anew. And also take into account that certain uses only require 6 inches of soil remediation. Other more intensive uses could require up to 8 feet of soil remediation and the costs that are associated with that. So I think it'll be a big conversation in the years to come, but the first step is we got to get the state to allocate the money to buy them out. And I think Representative Aisha Gomez has been a great leader on that front, and I'm looking forward to kind of standing shoulder to shoulder with her if it isn't something that gets done this session, that next session we pick that right up and work to get that current source of harm alleviated on our communities with all due haste.
Let's talk about leadership. So when voters think about Bill Emery and they want to know what you have been up to, like, can you talk about a time in the, you know, last couple of years, 5 years or so, where you saw a problem in the community and you did something to try and solve it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd and the civil unrest, civil uprising that we experienced in our community, I live not far from Lake in Chicago, and the encampments that started forming in Powderhorn Park were essentially my front yard. At night and on weekends, I was trying to be as present as possible in the encampments and providing services, distributing water, trying to get people connected to county resources that could support them. But then I also started working with folks who were putting together the proposal for the Avivo Village shelter in the North Loop. It was a tremendous team that came together, and I'm proud to have played a role in supporting Chair Fernando in finding the initial $2.1 million capital investment that the county put towards the project, which was enough of a sized contribution that it helped prompt the city and the state and other parties to come forward and bring capital dollars to bear. We also secured most of the shelter operating funds through CARES and ARP allocations through the county for the Avivo Village program. There was a little bit of a political football late 2020 as to what the site would be. And, Commissioner Fernando, I'm really proud to say, was like, put it in my district at a time when, you know, most political leaders are not looking to put a shelter, emergency shelter in their district. She was like, put it in mine, let's make it happen. And then I also recruited a friend of mine to come in who works as a commercial real estate broker, and she played a marvelous role working with all of the parties to get through city permitting and through the fire code and all of these different pieces. One example that we had to navigate was the tiny homes that are used within the facility. They were not rated. They didn't have fire rating for indoor uses in Minnesota. They worked in other places. And so in order to work around that, we removed the roofs from all of them because they didn't need a roof. They were inside in a broader warehouse setting. And that was enough for them to then qualify and for the project to move forward. So there was a lot of last minute decisions that needed to be made quickly and funds allocated in order to get it open on a timeline that was responsive to community. And I'm really proud of the role that I played in helping get that facility up and running and operational.
So you're a good person to talk to. We can skip ahead to the homelessness section because you are coming from a county perspective. You work for a county commissioner. And so the city has come under fire for encampment response, the evictions, Camp Nanukasi. They keep moving it around from place to place, which I think is in is in 62B, right?
Every location that Camp Nanukasi has been sited at is within 62B. That's correct.
And so one of the things you hear from Mayor Fry and some council members is the county is resourced to do the human services. Like, all we can do is move it around. And if the problem isn't solved, this is my interpretation. If it's not solved, then look to the county. The county's not doing what they need to do. How am I to interpret what the problem is here? Can you explain what's not going right from a government perspective?
Well, I think that the characterization that you offered there on behalf of some political leaders in Minneapolis is just inaccurate based on statute and funding requirements. There is no requirement in the state of Minnesota for any agency or level of government to provide shelter. There's not. We do not have a right to shelter in Minnesota. I wish we did, but we don't. And so Hennepin County, under the visionary leadership of County Commissioner Gail Dorfman and others, started really investing in shelter capacity within the city of Minneapolis and in Hennepin County more broadly. And so Hennepin County provides 95% of the local share dollars that are invested in emergency shelters anywhere in the state of Minnesota. But to be clear, there is no state mandate, and the state resources that are provided to operate shelters are scarce and lacking. So to say that it's the county's responsibility is to say, well, the county is the only agency essentially that has taken the responsibility of trying to provide shelter in the state of Minnesota almost. I mean, Ramsey has been a pretty good partner, but as a jurisdiction, they're so much smaller, and it's harder for them to allocate resources on this basis. And the city of Minneapolis to this day does not provide any dollars for operating for emergency shelter. And I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear that. I mean, the city of Minneapolis has contributed capital funds, but there are no operating dollars allocated from the city of Minneapolis to any of the shelters in the city. I want to say, too, that the encampment response that has been used against the Camp Nanukasi residents is inhumane and undignified. Hennepin County revised its encampment policy for encampments that are formed on Hennepin County lands, like at the Midtown Greenway, for example, in 2020. And our practices, though they still can involve an eviction component if there's an imminent threat to property or to life, are much more humane than the city's. First off, Hennepin County will devote considerably more resources to outreach teams and to social worker and trying to get connected almost on a daily basis with residents in encampments that may form on county sites to try and find placements for them. If encampments start to grow too large, they will work with the camp organizers to create multiple locations to spread them out a little bit more so it's easier to keep track of what's going on and what's coming into the camp and what's coming out of the camp. And then finally, if an eviction is required, Hennepin County will provide transport to people to a nearby location of their choice. And will store their belongings until such time that they can retrieve them. I think the city of Minneapolis should adopt Hennepin County's encampment policy. I'm kind of surprised and shocked at times that they haven't. And I wish that the city of Minneapolis, instead of allocating all that money to creating harm and disrupting the lives of our most vulnerable residents, would allocate that money towards operating dollars for shelters in our area. We've got shelters that could expand capacity if there were more operating dollars. And, I think the more appropriate space to seek those funds is from the state. This is a statewide problem. It should have a statewide solution, not a statewide problem with a county solution. And so I'm interested in going to the state and getting more operating dollars allocated for emergency shelter so that we can have another Vivo Village setting, one that focuses on harm reduction interventions, one that... you know, allows people to bring their pets with them. A big barrier to people seeking shelter is fearing that they would have to surrender their cat, their dog, their bird, their lizard. Avivo Village can accommodate that. Shelter settings where people can seek shelter with their romantic partner or with an adult child. Many of our shelter settings require people to separate, and I think that we need to be moving towards funding the types of shelters that encourage our unhoused neighbors to come inside.
Are you ready for another intractable, impossible to solve problem? You ready for another one?
I mean, they're already out there. We might as well discuss them.
education, a similar question, like define what the problem is and like, how do you go to the legislature and fix it? I imagine it's resources.
Yeah. So I'll have to say at the jump, you know, education is outside of my own policy expertise, and I have a lot to learn from people who have, you know, more years of experience and leadership in this area. But I think many of the problems that I identify in the education space really do come back to a lack of funding. The Pawlenty administration did such incredible harm to the education infrastructure, especially K-12 in the state of Minnesota, that we're still kind of digging out from that time. So even though there was a 10.3% increase in per cap student spending last year, you know, we are still far behind where the state of Minnesota was in the late 80s and early 90s, adjusted for inflation, when you think of that per capita number. I also think that we, that per cap number, sometimes there have been years where legislators have passed a modest increase, a 2.2% increase, 3% increase. But if English language learning programs and special education programs are growing, you know, some years at 8 or 9% a year, then that increase gets wiped away pretty quickly. You know, I think we saw some success with budgetary decisions that moved Metro Mobility out from under Metro Transit's mainline budget so that we could demonstrate the two different cost curves that we're developing there. And that helped create the political will to get the sales tax passed. And I think we should look at that for education, making sure that English language learning and special education programming across the state are looked at as their own programs, their own priorities, and have legislators, as I hope to be, sit at the table and look at those numbers in addition to the per capita spend so that they can really see where the cost trends are in education and appropriate funds on that basis.
Are you worried that the DFL will not be in charge for very much longer? And like that, it just makes, I don't know, I'm not a capital watcher, but it seems like that would make all of these problems just impossible to solve. Like a lot has gotten done in the last year or two.
Yeah.
But if you don't hold on to the majority, you're going into the legislature and you won't be able to do anything.
Yeah, I think to those who believe, you know, in the power of the pendulum and that a swing one direction will necessitate a swing in the other direction, there is certainly a sense of unease that that we're going to lose the House and what are we going to do then? I think that, you know, the left writ large has done a pretty incredible job in Minnesota of building relationships among each other, of coming up with clear, consistent messaging, and of really engaging voters. I would like to think of myself as part of that effort over the years. And I think we're running on some pretty popular wins right now. I mean, I've watched online debates and in-person debates, strangely enough, where the Democratic candidate is talking about how proud they are to make sure that school lunches were funded, and a Republican candidate is saying that not every child deserves to have a meal. So, you know, if those become the central themes of the campaign this year, I think we have a pretty good shot of retaining the majority and continuing to do work that the people of Minnesota are expecting their legislators to do. And, you know, I have considerable campaign experience. I was Ilhan Omar's first campaign manager when she ran for state house. I helped with Mary Moriarty's campaign when she ran for Hennepin County attorney. Obviously, Irene's campaign before I started serving in her office. And many others along the way. You know, should I be the person who's endorsed or nominated in this race? I look forward to help keeping that majority and doing a lot of door knocking myself in the suburbs and greater Minnesota communities that we need to win in order to keep governing.
What do you make of this Uber and Lyft stuff? Because it feels like these rideshare companies are leveraging the entire region against Minneapolis by saying, for in Uber's case at least, we're pulling out of the metro area rather than just like we're going to stop operating in Minneapolis to try to, I think, pressure the state legislature to preempt Minneapolis's rideshare pay increase. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen this story play out in so many industries over the course of American history, where you have workers who are trying to make a decent living and are organizing and are crying out that the system doesn't work for them. And we have large, unaccountable corporations that practice all sorts of crazy, dirty tricks in order to avoid paying their workers what the labor is worth. And I think in this case, we have particularly unaccountable corporations in Uber and Lyft because of how few staff they have in the state outside of drivers. I mean, they basically don't exist in Minnesota except on paper. And if it were not for the drivers, providing transport, they almost don't exist here at all. It's all in the Bay Area. So I stand with the workers. I have not reviewed the various reports in depth, but I think based on the assessment I have, any way you cut it, workers are currently being paid less than the minimum wage in the city of Minneapolis. And if organizing within the city of Minneapolis and Minneapolis City Council action gets these corporations to pay, living wages or something close to it to the workers, in this industry, then that's a win for the labor movement. And I'm a union guy. That's where I'm going to always come down on it. and certainly in this case, based on what I've seen.
The 2040 plan issue and the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, there's a bill at the legislature to fix that so that people can't weaponize environmental law to go after comprehensive plans that increase housing density that is widely understood by climate scientists, dense pedestrianized cities, to be actually good for the environment. Do you support that fix?
Yeah, I certainly support the bill that would amend MIRA. I think, my perspective is substantially informed by frequent Wedge Live guest, Peggy Sue Imahe, and her editorial in the Star Tribune and the language that she used, that trying to apply environmental review standards to a comp plan is like trying to study a elephant with a telescope or something, is what the framework she used.
With a microscope,
excuse me, yeah. The other way around. Both equally silly propositions. Really helps to underline this. Look, urban planners are generally very cerebral people. They don't tend to be the ones jumping up and down and shouting. They like to take their time and develop and then look at maps and all of that stuff. When they are jumping up and down and pulling their hair and saying something is wrong, there's probably something deeply wrong. And I think that based on the experts in this field, the judge's ruling is incorrect. And if it's something that for some reason doesn't get done this session, I hope that we get it done in the future so that we aren't stalling this important progress towards a sustainable climate unnecessarily.
You don't have to respond to this, but I've enjoyed watching Republican legislators make common cause with Minneapolis's pretend environmentalists during the hearings. That's been funny.
It is politics. What's the phrase? Politics makes strange bedfellows. Mm-hmm. You see that on a whole range of issues. I don't know what to make of it. I have not seen the same comments you're talking about, but it doesn't surprise me either.
It was a guy who was like, why are you telling me what I can do with my rocks and trees up in northern Minnesota? I think he's referring to mining, maybe. I don't know what the tree issue is. But his argument didn't make sense. I think he just likes sticking it to the city of Minneapolis, which is not unusual. Another housing and land use question. There's a bill to legalize missing middle housing, which are things like fourplexes and duplexes in statewide based on the size of the city. Density bonuses for things like affordability and sustainable building practices. Is that the kind of bill you would support?
I certainly like the concept. I have not read the bill in its entirety, so I'm generally supportive of it. I think that I would like to prioritize construction of this missing middle housing closer to transit access, and you know, building dense housing in places where other infrastructure has not been built to support it. It makes a little bit less sense to me, but. I'll have to be honest, I have not read that bill language yet, and I try not to comment too much on bills that I haven't read. But I support the concept, and, you know, I own a duplex in South Minneapolis, and we're building a garage. Our garage, when we bought the house, the garage was a parallelogram in every dimension. It was definitely collapsing and needed to come down. So we're rebuilding a new one, and at some point I'd like to put a small apartment on top of that garage. And, you know, I live on the second floor with my wife and my daughter. My mother-in-law lives on the first floor. This seems like a perfectly reasonable way to expand to urban living. And, you know, before the ADU requirements and before the 2040 plan, this property is zoned R2. I wouldn't have been able to put an apartment above a garage on this property. So, I think we need to be continuing to liberalize our, zoning requirements and restrictions so that people can build housing that makes sense in their context.
Okay, I'm asking you the parking minimums question. Eliminate parking minimums statewide. This is another bill at the legislature.
Yeah, I support that. I think that may not end up being the biggest barrier over time. I think that investors are parking cautious. And so, you know, there's a lot of work to be done about working with banks and other lenders so that they feel comfortable funding developments that that have less parking on site or areas around them that have less parking. But yeah, I support lifting that. That seems like a silly requirement.
I mean, I think it's made a big difference in Minneapolis. I think the 2040 plan gets a lot of media attention, but like eliminating parking minimums and the parking reform of the mid 2010s actually is responsible for a lot of the building. Like investors have gotten more comfortable with building less parking.
Yeah, I just don't want us to think of it as a one shot and we're done and then we don't have to advocate about this ever again. Like, it will be a huge win and then there will be more work to do. And I would say that the investors in Minneapolis have a different approach than investors in other communities as well. So that same activism may need to continue in other contexts as well. But yep, you're right. Agreed.
Traffic enforcement cameras for things like speeding, running red lights, that's another bill at the legislature currently. Is that a good idea?
So I'm originally from Western New York. Rochester, New York has had traffic speeding cameras for a number of years now. There are proponents. There are people who fiercely oppose them. I think that legislation, which I also have not read yet, forgive me, I've only been in the race about a month, so I have a lot to get caught up with. The question for me really lies in the implementation of it. Where are those cameras going to be posted? Who are the travelers on that route? How are we making sure that traffic enforcement by camera is less discriminatory and prejudiced than police enforcement that preceded it here in Minneapolis? Generally speaking, though, I think we do need to return to a place where traffic enforcement is happening in the city. And so as long as we can, as long as the legislation can be drawn up in ways that addresses privacy concerns and reduces the discriminatory effect that we see with technology that's been rolled out in law enforcement, like ShotSpotter technology, for example, being concentrated only in brown and black neighborhoods. As long as the technology is implemented in a way that keeps a close eye on privacy and discrimination concerns, I think that we need to be moving towards traffic enforcement again. I think we've all observed just atrocious driving behavior, especially in the wake of the pandemic and we need to find ways to hold folks that are putting other people's lives at risk accountable.
Public safety. So I imagine you're making a lot of phone calls to delegates. Are you getting a lot of public safety questions?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you tell them?
So I think I get a lot of questions that are framed around public safety, policing, and or crime. When we talk about policing, I think, you know, something that I share with people outside of the Minneapolis context that they're always surprised about is that they are aware that Minneapolis police department, obviously through the murder of George Floyd and others, has a history of negative encounters with community, brutal encounters with community. But a lot, what a lot of folks don't know is how ineffective MPD has been historically at solving crimes. I mean, there are some years that our homicide rate, clearance rate in the city of Minneapolis is as low as like in the 60% category, and especially in certain geographies, even lower than that. So we need a police force that reduces the amount of negative interactions that it has with our community members, while at the same time focusing on investigating crimes that do take place and finding, you know, finding ways to seek justice for victims of those crimes. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of work to do on that front. I support ending qualified immunity for officers in the state of Minnesota. I think that that's a barrier to accountability that we really need to look into. But at the same time, I think we need to be investing in the investigative capabilities so that the clearance rates go up. And I think the best way to do that is to move officers out of functions that they are currently being asked to do that we don't need someone with a badge and a gun performing. So, you know, traffic enforcement would be one of those spaces. I think there are lots of others where we expect police officers to both, you know, have their eyes on all corners of a situation and have a clipboard in hand and, you know, connect people to resources. And when I think about that, I think about 911. I mean, there was a time when I was young where we would call 911 and you'd expect an ambulance to come. Now when you call 911, you expect a police car to come. I'm hopeful that we can envision a future where when you call 911, you receive the type of emergency service that is tailored to the emergency that you are experiencing or that you are witnessing. And so for some situations, that will still be a police officer. But for many situations, it will be fire. It'll be EMS. It'll be mental health care workers. It might be a social worker connecting someone to resources. And in order to get there, there's a lot of state legislative changes that we need to look into. For example, the only people that are allowed to do mental health transports are first responders. And first responders under state law are defined as police, fire, and EMS. So you almost can't get a ride to 1800 Chicago to receive mental health counseling and support if someone's in crisis unless you do so in the back of an ambulance or the back of a police car. Both are contexts which can, you know, make that situation worse under certain circumstances. So we got to expand the definition of who can provide mental health transports and who can be working in innovative ways in emergency services. I'll also admit on this one, it's not necessarily my policy expertise area, and I'll be looking to leaders in the legislature like Representative Cedric Frazier, Representative Athena Hollins, and others that have taken a close look at this in order to kind of chart the right path forward. But we're not in a good place with public safety and policing in Minneapolis, and I'm hopeful that we can change the state laws that prevent us from getting to that place.
So what is your signature issue when people think of Bill Emery? What is the issue you are most comfortable with?
I'm most comfortable talking about housing. So, you know, in partnership with Chair Fernando back in 2019, we helped launch the supportive housing strategy through Hennepin County. This is a 10-year, $100 million program that invests in housing at affordable to 30% of area median income, paired with the supportive services that many people at that income level need in order to be stable in their housing. And is on track to produce 1,200 units of housing at that level through the course of that 10 years. I'm also proud of the work that we did during the pandemic when CARES dollars were allocated. Chair Fernando, myself, some leading staff leaders in Hennepin County Housing and Economic Development spotted kind of a loophole in the CARES dollars. Emergency authorization allowed us to make capital acquisitions, and we bought hotels. So the Metro Inn down on Lindale and 60th, University Inn, a couple other contexts, we purchased them initially for medical isolation during COVID. But when the CDC guidelines change, we started renovating them and shifting them to social service providers. And those are single room occupancy housing now, accessible again to income levels as low as 30% of area median income and below, again, paired with supportive services. And by the end of that program, I think we're going to be creating another 400 or 500 units of deeply affordable housing. I also used to work for Aon, which is a nonprofit housing developer, earlier on in my career. And so I, you know, the $1 billion in housing bonds that passed last session is great. Excellent, long overdue. But when you think of the scale of the affordability crisis in Minnesota, and you think about $1 billion statewide, we're going to need continuing ongoing investment in construction of new affordable housing in all communities across the state if we're going to start bringing rents down to a place where people aren't as rent burdened. And so I'm interested in working with Representative Mike Howard, who I see as a strong leader on housing, and other folks in the legislature to continue to have dollars allocated for capital investment in new affordable housing. We need a lot more of it, and we're going to need to keep working on that for years to come.
So you mentioned the hotel conversions, and it reminded me of Michael Rainville saying that one of those conversions was going to bring crime. Maybe it was the university one. Is that the one?
Trying to comment on everything that any given city council member will say on a given day is a wild goose chase, perhaps. But in the city of Minneapolis, every SRO facility has to be operated by a nonprofit, and those nonprofits certainly are experiencing challenges, but they just have a different staffing model than for-profit landlords. And so I think that the people living in those units are going to get the supportive services that they need to be stable in their housing. And kind of like Avivo Village and these other settings that we've been able to work on, I expect that the community will be supportive of it once it's populated and operating.
I didn't want you to give a substantive response. I just wanted to make fun of Michael Rainville for being a ridiculous person.
I also have to work with Councilmember Rainville and his aides on a regular basis. I've known Councilmember Rainville for over a decade. I can disagree with him on that one point.
So is Irene Fernando's office made peace with Michael Rainville? I remember she basically wrote him off publicly in pretty strong terms that I agreed with back a couple of years ago.
Made peace is an interesting characterization. I don't know that that is necessarily how I'd describe it, but certainly there are constituent services concerns that we need to work on together. And residents expect that people in politics will put away any petty disagreements and focus on solutions for them as the primary objective. And so, I think there's still pretty pronounced disagreements on different issues between Councilmember Rainville and Chair Fernando, but we want to make sure that there's pedestrian safety improvements on Washington Avenue North, and that's something that we've been able to collaborate on. And we want to make sure that the planning process for the Blue Line Extension light rail goes smoothly, and that's something that we've been able to collaborate and communicate on. Just because you disagree on some things doesn't mean you can't find ways to work on other things. That's my take.
Okay. So, you know what the problem with candidates, DFL candidates in Minneapolis is? That you all sound the same. All of your websites, you have a pretty good website. All your websites have the same buzzwords. So if you had to differentiate yourself between your competitors in 62B, why do you stand out? Why are you best suited for this job?
Yeah, so I think the biggest contrast is approach and who has a proven track record in governance. So Hennepin County, trying to get policy passed at Hennepin County is a lot more similar to trying to get policy passed at the state level, both in terms of the size of the budget and the way that things move through process there, than it would be, I would argue, at the school board level or the park board level, as two of the other folks in the race have served at. And in those jurisdictions, you have a strong superintendent of parks, superintendent of schools, who you can communicate policy preferences to. They go back, work with staff, huddle for 2 or 3 months, and then come back to you with a proposal, and you keep workshopping it until it's passed. At Hennepin County, at least for the first several years, Commissioner Fernando was not consistently in a governing majority. And so the only way for us to work to get policy passed was to build relationships with people within departments and agencies across the county, and find ways to get folks who, pretty explicitly are not supposed to necessarily work with you, to work with you to develop policy in ways that achieve your stated aims, and also perhaps more importantly, don't create unintended outcomes, so that by the time you bring a policy forward, it is well-researched, well-supported, it's got its footnotes and citations and everything that that are required for good policy, and hopefully you line up the votes to pass. That's the type of approach I can bring to the state legislature. I have some relationships within various departments across the state. I will look to build more and make sure that when I'm bringing forward policy on behalf of our communities, that it does exactly what our communities desire and doesn't create unintended consequences. And so I think that that's something different. And I can point to, you know, policy accomplishments in partnership with Chair Fernando to that effect. And that's something that I believe, you know, I have something to offer to this conversation of who should be the next rep in 62B.
When is the convention, the nominating convention?
April 14th, 9 o'clock registration, 10 o'clock call to order, Washburn High School.
Okay. So final question, do you have any recommendations for the audience? Have you been, you have a new hobby, a book, a movie? What are you enjoying lately that you think other people should take a look at?
Yeah, so my new hobby has been running for office, and it's almost completely consumed my time, but I don't necessarily recommend that for anyone or everyone. I would say I've the fourth season of True Detective, really good. Really weird, but also really good. I've been enjoying that and has given me cause to try and catch the other seasons as well to the extent that I'm able to watch TV.
I didn't like the ending. I enjoyed the show and the setting and the characters, but when it got to the ending, it kind of made me mad.
That, I respect that. I'm not as animated about it as you are, but I do respect that.
Because having the younger police officer just walk off into the sunset and basically, I don't want to, no spoilers, Bill Emery, for people who haven't done it, but like, we know what happened there, Bill, and I was not happy with that ending.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I would have liked to see a different arc there too, but
because that's not a happy ending. That's not a good end.
It's not. I think that a lot of TV writers have, you know, especially that we're in a postmodern era, really have a penchant for ambiguity and endings that don't end. And sometimes that's much less satisfying than a conclusive ending.
And it would have been okay if they hadn't characterized, like they made it seem like a happy ending. But it's not.
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to be happy that things turned out this way. I'm not happy about that.
I mean, are you supposed to? Like, there's a lot of people that die in the course of a True Detective season.
But, like, at the ending, it's all sunshiny and, like, look, everyone is in a better place. But no, we're not in a better place. It's hard to talk about this without spoilers. Maybe people have already had it spoiled for them.
Edit that in. Yeah, I mean, I think the happy ending is that the light has come back, the light has returned, and the long dark winter, you know, has come to an end, and that's maybe the note that we can take here, which, not that we had a long dark winter, we had a long, shallow, and balmy winter, but the days are getting longer, and the sunshine is coming back, and even if we don't feel great about it, we can at least feel good in the sun.
Okay. Well, thank you for that TV conversation here at the end. Bill Emery, candidate for Minnesota House in 62B. Convention is coming up whenever Bill said it was in April. And this is the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. Thank you for listening.
This is a real thing. Real thing. None of you have the balls to stop this.
I have got plenty of time. I have nothing else going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. Right now.